computer and the university.
Yeah, please. Great. Thanks. And thank you for inviting me, and thank you for coming. And let's hope that I click on the right thing. Okay.
Click on the right
thing. Got it. All right. So, lump and surveillance. I'm bringing you for an ethnographic moment to my field site in North Philadelphia. And I'll start with a field note from one of my collaborators, Fernando Montero. The block was raided again last night at 8:30 p.m. Three undercover cars, a paddy wagon, and a police cruiser swooped in, driving against the direction of our street's one-way traffic. They arrested four people, including Papo downstairs, my downstairs neighbor. The police are raiding daily now. Yesterday, Smokey was arrested with five bundles of heroin around the corner, and the day before, Tito was arrested on my stoop. Why was it so peaceful the entire summer, with sales just as intense as they are now? I start taking photos from my bedroom window, this is Fernando's note continuing, on the third floor to document the raid without getting arrested. Unfortunately, Murphy is the officer in charge, and when he realizes that I'm taking photos of him and his squad, he starts shouting angrily, "Let me know when you're going to take a picture so I can smile for you. And don't just take photos of the cops. Take photos of the dealers, too. Make sure to take some pictures of the drug dealers and send them to me, all right? All right? Yo, and is Philippe in there with you, bud? The professor I locked up last year?" Laughing and pointing down the block. "I handcuffed him right there. Huh? Where's Philippe at? Make sure I don't have to go up in there after you again." Fernando's continuing. And this is actually a detail for you, John, making race one of the rare moments that race is made visible legally. "I'm relieved," this is Fernando writing, "I'm relieved that they don't mention my name or refer to the class action lawsuit against arbitrary racialized police stop and searches that I'm a party to. They actually won that lawsuit in Philadelphia, and they now have to document a racial profiling systematically. Okay, the undercovers go back to searching the abandoned house next door. They obviously do not have the slightest clue about the structure of sales, how the structure of sales operates on the block. Meanwhile, two undercovers have knocked to the ground and handcuffed the night shift hustlers. 40 minutes later, unable to find any drugs, they release two of them. I'm surprised that the police didn't simply plant drugs on them, the way they did to Smokey and Tito on the two raids earlier this week that also came up empty of drugs. My neighbor, Papo, unfortunately, is still lying handcuffed across the street, and they drag him into the paddy wagon along with two unlucky customers hauled in from down the block. Once the cops leave, I run downstairs, and less than 15 minutes later, the flow of drug customers has resumed. Negro, one of the hustlers who was released, shakes my hand, thanking me for taking pictures. "Good looking out. Murphy wanted to whoop your ass." Negro is convinced my camera prevented the undercover squad from planting drugs on him. Now, that's the end of the field work. Field note. In a nutshell, I want to pick apart and contextualize the details of police narcotics raids to argue that in the current punitive neoliberal era of hyper-carceralization of U.S. inner-city residents, surveillance has become a class privilege. The vast majority of the inner-city poor are not systematically surveilled. The war on drugs is simply a dragnet that sweeps into prison whatever it catches. Street-level drug dealers are subject to a de facto police strategy of petty brutality, routine practices of planted drugs and testimony fabrications, and inconsistent, often arbitrary enforcement practices that seesaw idiosyncratically from very generous or incompetent lenient outcomes to draconian cruelty. Inner-city neighborhoods, like the one we've been working in since 2007, have become nurseries for filling prisons with young Black and Latino men, and increasingly with large numbers of women being locked up as well. The vast majority of the youth on our block, virtually all of whom are Puerto Rican, get sucked into the street-level drug trade during early adolescence, and most end up heading for adult careers of chronic incarceration. two members of our ethnographic team, Fernando and George, who you see in the picture, have been living on a heroin and cocaine selling block in North Philadelphia. As in many U.S. inner cities beset by public and private investment, the drug economy has filled the vacuum left by deindustrialization. That's a bundle of heroin. It's a brand name, Toyota. And drug selling has become the most readily accessible, equal opportunity job for poor male high school dropouts. The Puerto Rican corner of North Philadelphia that we're studying is the city's most active open-air drug market. Most of the clients are poor whites, and within 200 meters of our apartment, one can buy at virtually any time of day or night heroin, cocaine, both in crack and powder form, PCP, referred locally as wet or embalming fluid, marijuana, and diverted prescription pills, primarily benzodiazepines such as Xanax or Clonopin, and opiates, primarily Percocet. The form of state power most present in the inner city is police enforcement, of course, of the war on drugs. And at the street level, this massive investment of tax dollars follows an opportunistic logic of overfunded incompetence rather than one of systematic surveillance. For example, when I asked the lawyer who eventually defended Papo, our downstairs neighbor, whether the police understood the structure of drug dealing in Philadelphia, he laughed. Not at all. They're too ignorant, uneducated, and disorganized. We all know the war on drugs is ridiculous, but it pays their mortgage, and it pays my mortgage, and it pays the judge's mortgage, not to mention the prison guard's pensions. We've been documenting the details of the bizarre cat-and-mouse relationship between many of our drug-selling neighbors and the city's so-called elite narcotics strike forces. Police raiding patterns wax and wane, but make no visible dent in the flow of drug sales. On good days, a half dozen young men on our block sell over 1,000 $10 packets of heroin and cocaine. Narcotics officers primarily arrest addicted customers and street-level drug dealers. In 2009, for example, there were 14,202 drug-related arrests in Philadelphia, and well over half of those, 9,075, were for simple possession rather than for sales. Routinely, narcotics officers have so little surveillance knowledge, as Fernando's notes show, of operations, that they have to plant drugs on the suspects to make cases. Now, this kind of petty police malfeasance happened to me one night on the block early in my field work, as Murphy had triumphantly reminded everyone on the street when Fernando temporarily turned the surveillance table on him and his undercover narcotics team with his camera. When back then in 2008, when Murphy knocked me to the ground, handcuffed me, and kicked and fractured my ribs, he didn't know I was a professor or who I was. The arbitrariness of street-level police power and the irrelevance of facts and surveillance data at the street level became clear to me when Murphy and his team started debating, while I was on the ground with my face in the cement, whether or not they should bother bringing me into the station and arresting me. And then I'll read from my notes here. Finally, they start asking us for our names and addresses. I try to explain as politely as I can that I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, that I do public health research on HIV prevention. This elicits a loud guffaw. "Yo, guys, get a load of this. We got some white skin here." And he says he's a professor. This prompts a debate. Do we just take four of them, meaning the four young Puerto Rican men, three of whom had been selling heroin, and one of whom was simply hanging out chatting with us at the moment of the arrest? We already got two buyers from down there and two more from over there. They're referring to whether or not it's worth arresting me as a customer. They already have a bunch of customers that they need for proof, supposedly. To my surprise, Benito, the drug spot manager, tries to defend me and firmly tells the officers, "You can't say he was doing nothing. He's not a customer. He's a professor." This makes the officer laugh loudly and announce with a smile, "We can say whatever the fuck we want to say." It took 18 hours for me to be released on my own recognizance from the police district holding cell back then in 2008. It then took me 10 more months and over $12,000 and the full support of my university's legal team and a regionally respected ultra-leftist human rights lawyer to finally have the charges dropped. Unlike the drug dealers arrested with me, I had, obviously, the institutional, economic, and cultural capital to mobilize technology and surveillance in my favor. I submitted myself to several thousand dollars worth of DNA testing to prove to my university that there was no trace of my cells or fingerprints on the bags of heroin the police claimed I had purchased. As a matter of fact, the university paid for that separately because they wanted proprietary access over the data. And the rest of it I had to pay for up front, and then they said they would reimburse me if I was indeed innocent. The university also seized my computer. And subjected it to a forensic digital image, and sent my tape recorder to a forensic data recovery firm, which promptly returned it unsaved, saying because they found out that it was the police that had erased the files, because I taped my getting arrested, and they didn't. They had too much business with law enforcement and didn't want to jeopardize the relationship. So eventually, frightened of a lawsuit by my expensive, high-powered attorney, the prosecutor's office diverted the power vectors of surveillance and had the Philadelphia Police Commissioner send out my photograph, my CV, and a cover memorandum to the five commanding officers of North Philadelphia's police districts and narcotics units, introducing, quote, Professor Philippe Bourgois, who is conducting federally funded research on HIV prevention. As a condition of the professor's federal funding, he is prohibited from discussing his findings without advance permission from the federal government. Bummer. In contrast, all four of the neighbors arrested with me that night, including the young man who was not selling drugs, took plea bargains that involved combinations of 1 to 2 years of jail time and mandatory drug treatment. Rigorous surveillance played no part in their charges or in the evidence presented in their court cases. The police simply invented their so-called surveillance evidence, with an elaborate, inconsistent description of seeing me, they actually used me by name, purchasing heroin, along with three other whites who had actually been arrested on a different block, buying a different brand of heroin, because as you saw, the heroin packets are stamped. So you can keep track of, if you did surveillance, you could easily keep track of everything. I want to emphasize that being subjected to surveillance in the United States is actually a privilege. For example, George, one of the members of my ethnographic team, was mugged while walking home from the subway stop, returning to the block. He was coming from the University of Pennsylvania's library. And he went ahead and reported the assault to try to see how the police would deal with it. So from George's fieldwork notes. The detective leads me to his cubicle, and he double-clicks on the icon to load the case management system, but the system freezes. After 10 more minutes of clicking and waiting, he curses his computer and opens up a template Word document to manually type up an incident report, punching tentatively at the keys with only his index fingers and searching nearsightedly for each letter. Now, to summarize, because George gets a little bit smart aleck, you know how those 20-nothing-year-olds are with computers, he actually persuades the officer to let him take over his computer and go in and search the database for everyone that they've arrested over the past year to see what's there. The officer gets very confused and irritated and throws him out of the office. But not before George can pick up the images and realize that the images are so illegibly scanned into the computer that there's no way to even be able to look at them. You are able to search them if you know how to use a computer, but you can't do anything with them if you were trying to surveil. Now, had George been mugged on the other end of the subway ride, and this is for Setha, the private security force of the University of Pennsylvania's, University of Pennsylvania's private security force would have protected him, and he would have experienced a completely different regime of securitization. On the 10 or 20 square blocks surrounding the university, there are closed-circuit video cameras on nearly every corner, and bicycles patrol 24/7, rain or shine. Now, I want to then just end with the incoherence of surveillance in the inner city reflects a larger lumpenization process that has written off an increasingly large segment of the former working class. It is easier and cheaper to fabricate evidence than to surveil criminal activity. Ironically, the confusing way that surveillance, law enforcement, and court rulings are administered by what sociologists have called street-level bureaucrats, both on inner-city streets and in downtown courtrooms, creates a space for punitive police corruption and routinized police malfeasance and mediocrity, as well as extremes of hyper-punitive court-ordered sentences in reaction to the incompetence sometimes. Now, finally, the idiosyncratic street-level administration of the war on drugs that is both too incompetent and lazy to mobilize surveillance leaves the lumpenized victims of incarceration clueless about the devastating stakes of their petty crimes and bureaucratic transgressions, such as sleeping through an appointment with a probation officer that can sometimes mean do absolutely nothing for you. Sometimes they can lose you in the computer and forget about you, or it can get you sent to jail for months, or if it gets somehow aggravated and sent to a judge who's in a bad mood that day, it can get you sent to jail for several years. We've seen those outcomes. So I'll just end with this hideous picture that shows you, that was when Ronald Reagan came to power, is right where the curve goes up, 1980, and that's the rise in the prison population. Okay, thanks a lot.
Is Marie Gottschalk, also from the University of
Pittsburgh.